That's Detroit-born and Detroit-raised Johnny O'Neill at the piano, heavily influenced by jazz greats Oscar Peterson and Art Tatum, with Let Me Off Uptown, recorded in 1995. Taras Mateen on bass, Russell Malone on guitar, and Wally Muhammad on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It is Friday, the 28th of February, the last day of this month. Turmoil in Ukraine and Venezuela has dominated news headlines in recent weeks, keeping pace with an escalation in the violent opposition to the now ousted President Viktor Yanukovych and to President Nicolas Maduro's United Socialist Party of Venezuela's regime. Generally, the media report both as popular as struggles for freedom and democracy, echoing the open support and approval of the Obama administration. But what really is unfolding in these two countries? Noted historian, political analyst, social critic and author Dr. Gerald Horn, who has written more than 30 books and 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism, takes us behind the headlines today. Dr. Horn holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's a prolific author. And, as I said, he has authored more than 30 books and 100 scholarly papers. His undergraduate courses include the Civil Rights Movement and U.S. history through film. He teaches also courses in diplomatic history, labor history, and the 20th century African-American history. Thanks, Gerald, for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's start with the first question. What's going on in Ukraine and Venezuela? What is common to both of these struggles?
Well, first of all, I'm speaking to you from Howard University, where I'm working on a biography of Paul Robeson, where his papers are located right here in Washington. And I was just reading Paul Robeson's reflections on the Ukraine, where he visited a number of times. He spoke about Ira Aldrich, his predecessor's great interpreter of Shakespeare's Othello, just like Robeson was, and talked about Ira Aldrich's relationship with Taras Shevchenko, the great Ukrainian poet, who, of course, in many ways is considered the father of the Ukrainian language. And in reading about Robeson on the Ukraine, I had to reflect also upon Robeson's own experiences in the Ukraine, because to put it sharply and bluntly, what's happening in the Ukraine as we speak is that an unpopular regime headed by former President Yanukovych was swept out of power, at least temporarily, by a broad coalition of forces that included fascists, neo-fascists, and anti-Semitic elements. And it's quite disconcerting that the U.S. press, which I had thought at least was an opponent of anti-Semitism, would not be more vigorous in its analysis of some of these forces that have engaged in violence in the past week or so. I'm speaking of the Svoboda Party, which is now represented in the so-called new government in Kiev. And I'm also speaking of the so-called right sector, which is in a de facto alliance with the Svoboda Party. This development should be of all concern should be of utmost concern to peace-loving peoples. And I should also say that to a certain degree, what's happening in Ukraine is contrary to the stated goals of the U.S. administration and its North Atlantic allies. Recall that President Obama came into power talking about a reset with Moscow, and the subtext was that there would be a pivot towards Asia, towards China, a rising China in particular. And that's one of the reasons why some months ago, Mr. Obama went to Northern Australia and set up a U.S. military base for the first time in years in this country, basically as a way to better monitor and scrutinize China. The idea was that the United States could hardly confront China if it had bad relations with Moscow. But now it's helping to engender bad relations with Moscow, which in many ways is contrary to its stated long-term goal of confronting Beijing. Now, I understand to a degree what's going on. The U.S. administration and many in Washington in particular are very upset with Moscow because of Moscow refusing to go along with U.S. Syria policy. But keep in mind that Syria, in many ways, reflects what's going on in Ukraine. That is to say that the United States is willing to ally with ultra-right-wing forces in the al-Nusra Front because they have this obsession with sweeping aside President al-Assad in Damascus. Presumably, in both Syria and in Ukraine, the U.S. administration feels that ultimately, after these ultra-right-wing forces have done their dirty work, that these ultra-right-wing forces then can be swept aside. Now, that's a charitable interpretation. A less charitable interpretation is that the U.S. administration and its NATO allies are well aware of these neo-fascist hardline elements, and they're willing to play ball with them, even though we all know that they have a history of mass murder. It's quite alarming and quite disconcerting, I must say.
Well, not only do they tolerate it, Senator McCain was there signing autographs. U.S. Assistant Secretary Victoria Nuland was there handing out cookies to the new landlords, I suppose, of Ukraine. Canadian Foreign Minister John Baird was also there, cozying up to this group. But the United States has yet to use the word coup. Has, in your view, has a coup actually occurred here? What the U.S. is calling this cry for democracy and freedom?
Well, a coup is an appropriate term to use in this context. But let me also say that Washington and NATO are playing with fire. And I think we should also step back for a second and reflect upon relations between the North Atlantic countries and Moscow. There were those who were led to believe that once you got rid of the big bad communists in Moscow, all would be sweetness and light with regard to bilateral relations between Moscow and Washington and Moscow and Brussels. But we see in the cold light of history that that's not true, and that should lead us to a deeper analysis. And I'm afraid that that has not taken place. And one of the ironies is that the Obama administration, which has among its most stalwart supporters a black community that voted for him 90%+, but this black community, because of a historic bargain that led to the retreat of Jim Crow, has stood down from an analysis of foreign policy because we and the black community generally has seen what happened to Paul Robeson, for example, when he took a view contrary to U.S. elites on foreign policy, and what happened to Martin Luther King when he opposed the Vietnam War, et cetera. And so what this means is that Mr. Obama's most stalwart supporters are missing in action on the most pressing issues of the day. And what this also means is that right-wing forces, ultra-right-wing forces, can gain strength abroad and then deliver a heavy punch right here on the North American mainland, which basically exposes the debility and frailties of this policy of many in the black leadership and many black intellectuals who couldn't point out Ukraine on a map if you showed them the Crimea. And I think what we should also arrive at is that the United States, that is to say U.S. elites and their craven lust for global domination, have come to the conclusion, I think, that this less than admirable goal cannot be reached without having a Boris Yeltsin-type figure in power in Moscow. But this is very dangerous because Russia is still armed to the teeth. It's engaging in military maneuvers on the border of Ukraine as we speak. We saw what happened in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia approximately 6 years ago when Georgia and Moscow came to sharp blows, which led to a very crushing defeat for Georgia, as the United States was cheerleading on the sidelines, but found itself unable to come to Georgia's assistance. And I dare say that a similar result could unfold in Ukraine, and this could lead to untold deaths and damage to the Ukraine infrastructure.
Yes. One would assume that the United States would really not want to side with a situation where a coup, in fact, has been accomplished. This is not a democratic coup. This is not all of the people rising up. This is one half of Ukraine rising up. The other Russian-speaking half is unaccounted for.
Not only that, but you may know that part of the opposition to the apparently deposed President Yanukovych was the boxing champion, Vitaly Klitschko. Now, even though he was opposed to the now deposed regime, he is not part of the new government. He's standing down from the new government. And you should also know that he is widely seen as being in the pocket of Germany, of Berlin. And this bespeaks a rift in the North Atlantic Alliance, a rift that is of long standing. Recall that when present State Department official Victoria Nuland was caught on tape in a conversation that you can now find online talking about the Ukraine, she used a curse word in describing the European Union and implicitly describing Germany. This rift between Berlin and Washington comes on the heels of revelations about the U.S. administration bugging the mobile phone of Chancellor Angela Merkel. So this situation in Ukraine is all the more dangerous because the North Atlantic forces are not united, and yet they're trying to start a brush fire in President Putin's backyard. This is ominously dangerous, and I would hope that sober heads would not only intervene but prevail.
Well, the United States has, in effect, threatened Putin, who has mobilized troops to the border already, and who I think would move if, in fact, the situation further deteriorates. It's clear that the ousted president he considers weak, and the ousted president has now vowed that he will fight for Ukraine, until he is returned to power and until democracy prevails. So with that mounting militarism going on and the saber rattling by the United States basically telling Putin to stand down, do you expect that it would actually get to the point where military action, the United States will in turn do something of in a nature to signal that it too will take military action?
Well, let us hope not, although there are some worrisome signs, not least the kind of rhetoric that's emerging from the office of Senator John McCain of Arizona, who's just stopped short of ordering a bombing attack on Moscow as a result of this Ukraine crisis. We should also take note of the fact that just in this past week, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel announced that the U.S. military, specifically the Army, is reducing and shrinking in size to a level it has not seen in decades. This is a direct result of the pressure on the U.S. Treasury. It was decades ago that the first President George H.W. Bush announced that the United States had more will than wallet. The United States can hardly afford these misadventures it's involved in Afghanistan, not to mention the covert assistance it's funneling to rebels in Syria and elsewhere. And we have not even touched upon this crisis in Venezuela on the northern tip of South America, Venezuela being one of the major oil producers on this small planet where U.S. oil interests are heavily represented and have been for some years. And yet we see that the Caracas regime has expelled a handful of U.S. diplomats because of credible allegations of their being involved in helping to stir up unrest that has led thousands onto the streets. It's no secret that the United States has a bone to pick with President Maduro because he is seen as all too close to the late President Hugo Chavez. He is also seen as all too close to the Cuban regime in Havana, where he supplies subsidized petroleum. And in fact, it's no secret that just a few days ago in Havana, there was a major hemispheric meeting of Latin American and Caribbean nations where the United States and Canada were pointedly and specifically excluded. And put forward was a very progressive program, a program that you see dramatically reflected in some of the attempts by President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil to build an alternative society. And so Venezuela is very close to Havana, it's very close to Brazil, it's very close to Argentina, which is in perpetual conflict with Washington, it's very close with Bolivia as well, which has the same profile as Argentina. So Washington feels that a knockout blow against President Maduro in Caracas would send ripples throughout the hemisphere that would reach Havana, reach Brasilia, reach Buenos Aires, and reach La Paz. Once again, it's a very dangerous situation that's unfolding, and let us hope that cooler heads prevail.
To your view, why is the president so seemingly absent from the discourse of directly addressing these two situations?
Well, I'd like to look at this in terms of larger forces. That is to say that, as noted, one of the problems you have in the United States is that some of the most stalwart supporters of the Democratic Party now holding the White House is the black community, and the black community is leadership and intellectuals too, I might add, are ill-versed on the basics and fundamentals of foreign policy. And therefore, they're mute, sitting on their hands when these crises unfold, which automatically gives more strength to such voices as Senator John McCain. And we need to keep in mind that in this, quote, democracy, unquote, that exists in the United States, the president, even though he has a certain jurisdiction in terms of foreign policy, his jurisdiction is limited by the fact that powerful corporate interests also have a say. I'm speaking of the oil interests based in Houston, Texas, for example, who are very upset with the policies of the Caracas-based regime of President Maduro. And as well, you have many hawks who are historically upset with Moscow. In fact, I dare say that the kind of anti-Russian, anti-Moscow sentiment that was generated during the previous historical epoch, speaking of the Cold War, has yet to dissipate. And some of the venom that's directed at President Putin right now has a musty Cold War era vintage, which leads me to suspect that there is a fundamental and structural problem in terms of U.S. foreign relations because, as noted, the United States, or at least its leading elites, feel that world domination basically rolls through Moscow, and therefore you need a Yeltsin-type figure, that is to say a weak, laughable figure holding the reins of power in Moscow, if these ambitious dreams of these U.S. elites are to prevail. And it seems to me this is the proper context for trying to understand what's happening under the ostensible leadership of President Barack Obama.
This, what's surprising is the aggression, it seems, I could use that word freely here in this respect, the aggression of the European Union. One, I find that to be quite stunning that they, you know, they've been so blatantly aggressive in forging relationships with these forces that have, in effect, in one instance, already accomplished a coup by ousting the leader of Ukraine and seeking to do the same thing in Venezuela.
Well, I would say that there are splits and rifts in the European Union. First of all, there's been a sharp swing to the right. The European parliamentary elections will be taking place within a few months, and it's expected that the ultra-right-wing parties and forces, the Party of Freedom in the Netherlands, the UK Independence Party in Great Britain, the National Front in France, for example, will do quite well. I mean, this is quite shocking. I mean, France historically has been a bellwether of the left, but yet the neo-fascist National Front is expected to get more votes than any other party, including the ruling Socialist Party. keep in mind as well that the United States is getting ever closer to France, perhaps as a partial result of the strengthening of the right. You may have noticed that President François Hollande was in Washington just days ago, and Washington and Paris have collaborated in Syria, have collaborated in North Africa. Recall that they were the major engineers of the overthrow of President Gaddafi in Libya. And this hawkish attitude on the part of Paris, assisted by Washington, is something we're going to have to keep our eyes on for some time in the future. But once again, Germany is not necessarily on board. Recall that it stood down from the attack on Libya. And what we have to do, if we had a more wise leadership in our community, we would be seeing attempts in our community to reach out to the peace forces in Berlin and strengthening them while seeking to isolate their opposite numbers in Paris. But since that's not happening, there's much more of a likelihood that this right-wing trend that your question spoke to in the European Union will continue to grow and be augmented.
What about the role of Canada?
Well, Canada, as you know, has a sizable population of Ukrainian extraction. Then that population of Ukrainian extraction, I might say, just like the population of Ukrainian extraction in the United States, which is largely headquartered in the Midwest, say in Chicago, has very strong roots in the right-wing movement in Kiev. Not only that, but Prime Minister Stephen Harper is a Tory, is a conservative. In some ways, he's to the right of the U.S. administration, not only on the Ukraine, but on Israel as well. And it's very disappointing and very alarming because Canada likes to style itself as being to the left of the United States, which it generally is. It likes to style itself as a bellwether of peace and progress, and compared to the United States, it generally is. But on the Ukraine, is bankrupt.
I want to address this question about the legitimate claims of people who believe in both in the Ukraine and in Venezuela, who believe that the systems that they were living under were just getting a bit much. In Venezuela, there was a lot of corruption. There was scarcity of staples. You had too much violence and so forth. And this had been a growing theme. And there is no denying that many of these charges were quite legitimate. But of course, this is an evolving society, but at the same time, these were legitimate complaints. In the Ukraine, you also had legitimate complaints about corruption in government and, you know, the economic situation that was growing worse. So how is that going to be resolved? What is the percentage of blame, for lack of a better term, about these new systems coming into place? In Venezuela, for example, a very radical departure from the norm, trying to take the government in a particular direction, nationalizing many of the assets of the state, but still having to deal with overwhelming baggage it inherited that brought in this legitimate opposition, sorry, to corruption and to really harsh economic conditions. How would these things be resolved? Did they not provide, in a sense, a perfect foil for this so-called popular uprising in both Ukraine and in Venezuela?
Well, your question is well taken. The predicate of the question is well taken. The problem is that of the 190-plus member states in the United Nations, each and every one has flaws to a greater or lesser degree. The problem with the world today is that the United States and its allies chooses to single out certain regimes and highlight, underscore their flaws, and then turn to persons like myself and yourself and say, do you support those flaws? And if you say that you don't support these flaws, then they put forward the alternative, and you should participate in these actions to overthrow these regimes with flaws. Recall that that was the textbook recipe for the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya in 2011. And we know that since the overthrow of Gaddafi, there has been chaos and terror reigning supreme that has spread into neighboring Libya. And I would also say that it spread into northern Nigeria and helped to give fuel to the Boko Haram that specializes in blowing up schools with school children. So I think we have to, on the one hand, acknowledge what you said, that surely there are problems in Caracas, just as there were problems in Kiev under Yanukovych. But we must simultaneously reject the interference in the internal affairs of sovereign states by the United States and its North Atlantic allies bent upon regime change, because as Libya suggests and other examples too numerous to mention, their interference will not better the situation. Their interference will not create more humanitarian regimes. In other words, what happens with this external interference is that the situation oftentimes goes from bad to worse. It doesn't go from bad to better. And that's a very important lesson that we in North America have to learn.
Well, that leaves the question now with the so-called cool heads that normally would prevail just are not available right now, because they are aiding and abetting a very dark process here. Where would you see leadership, credible leadership, coming from to kind of dissipate the situation right now?
Well, fortunately, the U.S. ruling elite is split on Ukraine. And I think that's one of the reasons why the chief executive of the White House has been eerily quiet about this unfolding crisis. I recall seeing former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger on CNN just a few days ago, where he raised sobering questions about U.S. policy in the Ukraine and was strangely sympathetic to the dilemma that President Putin has been placed in. This is rather curious, given the fact that Dr. Kissinger has been something of a mandarin of U.S. foreign policy for decades now. But perhaps he recognizes, as I said in my opening remarks, that there are larger fish to fry. That is to say that it's going to be very difficult for the United States to do this pivot towards China or pivot towards Asia when it's perpetually involved in brush fires in places like Ukraine. Places like Ukraine, which although it has 50 million plus people and although it's equal to the ambitions of President Putin, it does not present a sizable market. It does not have natural resources along the level of Caracas with oil, for example. And in some way, it involves a dissipation of U.S. energy at a time when China is growing by leaps and bounds. And I must say, I'm not in favor of this pivot towards China, but on the other hand, I'm scratching my head and wondering what this fight in Ukraine has to do with this larger goal of confronting Beijing.
Well, what do you see in the immediate future unfolding? Is it going to have an even larger domino effect?
Well, if you look at the crisis that took place in Georgia, the former Soviet Republic of Georgia a few years ago, what happened was that there was a Russian military intervention, and the Georgians went fleeing into the night. And besides, they lost part of their territory, including Abkhazia and Ossetia. It would not surprise me at all if a part of Ukraine detached from Kiev, and you already, as we speak, have the streets of southern Crimea, mostly Russians, clamoring for such an eventuality. It's also interesting to note that the number two party in Moscow, I'm speaking of the former ruling communists, also have been very critical of this coup in Kiev and presumably will stand alongside President Putin, which is something unusual, his status and staunchest critics. I think you'll also find that the European Union and the United States will be unable to intervene along the lines that Senator John McCain is requesting. And in any case, I think you're going to see a deterioration of living standards in Ukraine, because keep in mind that package, the bailout package offered by Moscow weeks ago was larger than the bailout package being talked about by Washington, its North Atlantic allies, the International Monetary Fund, etc. And indeed, the latter forces are demanding Greece-style austerity in return for a bailout package, which means living standards will get worse, which will basically provide kindling for the flames of neo-fascism, which we already see burning in the streets of Kiev. That, I must say, is quite alarming.
Well, Gerald, thank you so much for being with us today and packing all this information. That was a textbook in itself on the primer on what's really behind the headlines in Ukraine and Venezuela. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks a lot. We'll take this break and come right back to my brother's keeper. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, yesterday the president held a briefing before a packed audience at the White House to announce an initiative that basically deals with the unique challenges of young African American boys, young Latino boys, and young men. They were getting a rough shake. They have been getting a rough shake. And this program, he says, will respond to their unique needs, specifically in three areas: in education, in the area of criminal justice, and employment. Here's how he expressed his feelings yesterday. Just a small clip, but this is basically his feeling as he announced the initiative yesterday.
We have opportunity for everybody. The notion that no matter who you are or where you came from or the circumstances into which you are born, if you work hard, if you take responsibility, then you can make it in this country. That's the core idea. And that's the idea behind everything that I'll do this year and for the rest of my presidency. Because at a time when the economy is growing, we've got to make sure that every American shares in that growth, not just a few. And that means guaranteeing every child in America has access to a world-class education. It means creating more jobs and empowering more workers with the skills they need to do those jobs. It means making sure that hard work pays off with wages you can live on and savings you can retire on and health care that you can count on. It means building more ladders of opportunity into the middle class for anybody who's willing to work hard to climb them. Those are national issues. They have an impact on everybody. And the problem of stagnant wages and economic insecurity and stalled mobility are issues that affect all demographic groups all across the country. My administration's policies, from early childhood education to job training to minimum wages, are designed to give a hand up to everybody, every child, every American willing to work hard and take responsibility for their own success. That's the larger agenda. But the plain fact is, there are some Americans who in the aggregate are consistently doing worse in our society. Groups that have had the odds stacked against them in unique ways that require unique solutions. Groups who've seen fewer opportunities that have spanned generations. And by almost every measure, the group that is facing some of the most severe challenges in the 21st century, in this country, are boys and young men of color. Now, to say this is not to deny the enormous strides we've made in closing the opportunity gaps that marred our history for so long. My presence is a testimony to that progress. Across this country, in government, in business, in our military, in communities, in every state, we see extraordinary examples of African-American and Latino men who are standing tall and leading and building businesses and making our country stronger. Some of those role models who have defied the odds are with us here today. You know, the Magic Johnsons or the Colin Powells. We're doing extraordinary things. The Anthony Foxes. Anthony, yesterday, he and I were talking about how both of us never knew our dads and shared that sense of both how hard that had been, but also how that had driven us to succeed in many ways. So there are examples of extraordinary achievement. We all know that. We don't need to stereotype and pretend that there's only dysfunction out there. But 50 years after Dr. King talked about his dream for America's children, the stubborn fact is that the life chances the average black or brown child in this country lags behind by almost every measure and is worse for boys and young men. If you're African American, there's about 1 in 2 chance you grow up without a father in your house. 1 in 2. If you're Latino, you have about 1 in 4 chance. We know that boys who grow up without a father are more likely to be poor, more likely to underperform in school. As a black student, you are far less likely than a white student to be able to read proficiently by the time you are in fourth grade. By the time you reach high school, you're far more likely to have been suspended or expelled. There's a higher chance you end up in the criminal justice system, and a far higher chance that you are the victim of a violent crime. Fewer young black and Latino men participate in the labor force compared to young white men. And all of this translates into higher unemployment rates and poverty rates as adults. And the worst part is we've become numb to these statistics. We're not surprised by them. We take them as the norm. We just assume this is an inevitable part of American life instead of the outrage that it is. That's how we think about it. It's like a cultural backdrop for us in movies and television. We just assume, of course, it's going to be like that. But these statistics should break our hearts, and they should compel us to act. You know, Michelle and I are blessed with 2 beautiful daughters. We don't have a son. But I know if I had a son, on the day he was born, I would have felt everything I felt with Billy and Sasha, the awe, the gratitude, the overwhelming sense of responsibility to do everything in my power to protect that amazing new life from this big world out there. And just as our daughters are growing up into wonderful, beautiful young women, I'd want my son to feel a sense of boundless possibility. And I'd want him to have independence and confidence. And I'd want him to have empathy and compassion. I'd want him to have a sense of diligence and commitment.
Yes, 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 yes. We get it. I don't want to sound cold-hearted. I really don't. But I was incensed about this yesterday. The wait was done. Of course, I understand you want to launch an initiative. He's managed to attract $150 million from foundations and companies, corporations, and other philanthropies, and with a promise of about $200 million more over the next 5 years into this particular program. And that's wonderful. But you see, I know about the flip side of what's going on, and that is why I'm so incensed about it. You drag out a whole group of black and Latino young men and boys, and you know, of course, they become the physical backdrop of this noble endeavor that you are going to undertake. By the way, it came out of Chicago, you see, Rahm Emanuel's Chicago. You remember him, Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff to the Obama administration, who went on to exploit the black vote and to get elected in Chicago, and to promptly do one of the things that the president just highlighted in terms of a number. He shut down the schools. He shut down, just last year, almost 50 schools in the city of Chicago. Now, when the president speaks about these lofty goals, listen to the language. The language is, you are far more likely to do so and so. You're far more likely to be a victim of crime. You're far more so and so and so. What he does is a very sinister kind of psychological trick, which is, at the same time you are basically touting your benevolence, you lift up the example of the problem and you objectify the problem. The person becomes the problem. You understand? It's like, I'm going to help you because more than likely this is going to happen to you, this is going to happen to you, this is going to happen to you. And see, I am here helping you. But he personalizes it and makes the young men and boys essentially the reason for the program, as opposed to a system that produces these results with which these young men and the young men that came before them and that will come after them had to live. He doesn't talk about systems. He can't talk about systems that could retrieve these young men and put them on the right path, because the systems available to them still, which have not been fixed in 5 years or even seriously attempted in the 5 years that he's been in office, those systems are working perfectly to produce exactly the same result that the president ostensibly is excoriating and saying, look, I'm providing you an alternative. I'm going to go to the philanthropic organizations, and I'm going to go to the corporations, and I'm going to go to community-based organizations, and we're going to solve this problem together so that the victims now are the recipients of a kind heart and of philanthropy. It is, in fact, their right. They have a right to be treated better than that. They have a right to an education that works. They have a right to have a good future. This president has not provided it. And the contempt, when you look behind all of this wonderful ceremony and all these wonderful black faces, the NAACP's over there, the Urban League and Sharpton and Colin Powell, and they're all there, and it's all wonderful, and we all know it's Black History Month, and we all know that there is a midterm election, and we know that in the end, it is politics. You make a show out of the misery of people, as if your $150 million is actually going to shift the systems of the criminal justice system, the educational system, in a direction where these young black men and Latino young black men and boys will actually have a future. The president prefers to talk about his philanthropy, and of course he reminds us for the umpteenth time that he didn't have a father. One of these days I will answer that question. One of these days I will answer that question. Yes, you didn't have a father, but look at me now. Look at me. I'm president of the United States. And you, I'm here to help you. I'm going to help you do these things. I'm going to help you be somebody. I'm going to give you a gift. The gift of, this is my largesse to you. This president has decided to abandon these young men and all these young children in the United States, but he is the school closingest president in the history of the United States. Has closed more schools in their own black and Latino communities than anybody in the United States in office as president. The jails are crammed. His own Justice Department has recorded how the school to prison pipeline works. The school system is, in fact, a pipeline to the prison system. His own Justice Department recorded that. Has it changed? No. That requires work. And in any event, these are not the children of the middle class. These are the children who deserve not, they don't have rights. They don't have a right to a good education. They don't have any right to expect that their lives should amount to something, that they should go to schools that actually teach and prepare people for a meaningful life. This president hasn't done a damn thing about unemployment for young working age teens, nor their fathers, nor their mothers. The unemployment rate of the parents of these young black and Latino men is higher than it's been since 1929. We have record poverty. We have record what he prefers to call economic inequality. You could call it whatever you mean, whatever you want. But this president has been part and parcel of the reason that these young men were standing there yesterday at the White House, and people are applauding because he is a very nicely orchestrated event. Come to the White House where I will tell you about my largesse. And it's just happening, just at a perfect time, because black folks do love symbolism. They never get substance. They just get symbolism. And here he is. He is going to help young black boys and young Latino boys and men, and with $150 million. And people were grateful. They were happy. The black leadership was just thrilled to death. It was the best thing. And yes, you have our vote again once more. You've just used our young boys to your advantage, but you have our vote. We don't have to worry now that you've set your mind to doing something, saving our young black men and our young Latino men. The president's contempt for the African American and Latino communities knows no bounds. And yesterday, glowing coverage oh, he's doing something quite affirmatively. You know, he's really stepping up. He's delivering. You really believe that a program of $150 million will actually deliver and actually turn around this dead-end educational system? It would actually stop this administration from closing more schools. It would actually increase employment opportunities for these young men and their parents. You really believe that? Well, it bothered me, so I thought I would share that with you. It is outrageous. These are the reasons that people really need to just sober up and say that there comes a point where you just can't allow yourself to be degraded any further and be used like this. And now he's using the children as a political prop, just in time to take the edge off Obamacare that will take your assets when you die. Is there any further contempt that you wish to take from this president? I know I'm done with that. This has got to stop. But yesterday, this was the sophisticated way, the backhanded compliment, if you will, where people praise you. You know, I don't know how she does it. I don't know how she does all that she does with just 25 cents. They're not even interested in saying that the obligation they have is to make sure that you just don't have only 25 cents. This president hasn't delivered for the black community, for black children, for black men, for black women, for Latino children, men, women, for Native Americans, has not delivered anything of substance. All we get is showtime. It was show and tell at the White House yesterday, and the media loved it. Let's trot out the little black boys, let's trot out the little brown boys, and we will say, here is a black guy just like you. And if I had a son, and this is what I would want for my son, he knows damn well his children are well taken care of, and they don't have to worry about having a good life. But there are millions and millions and millions of children all around the United States who, through no fault of their own, are consigned to school systems that dumb them down, that don't care whether they learn or don't learn. They are fodder for the criminal justice system. And then they are eventually pariahs of the society. They're convenient when you can snatch them and put a nice T-shirt on them and tell them, hey, stand right behind me while I talk about the great things I'm going to do. He's had 5 years, and he has not delivered, and he has no intention of delivering. The only thing that concerns this president is that he fulfilled the mission that he has been given by his masters. We've come to the end of our program today, and I want to thank you for your time, and I hope that, especially with Gerald Horn, that we learned quite a different appreciation of what's going on in Ukraine and in Venezuela. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or leadstories with Utrice Lead. Thanks again. Have a safe and an enjoyable weekend.